Welcome to episode 9 of Confessions of a Casting Director, a podcast where you will hear advice, wisdom, and true stories from inside the audition room. I'm your podcast host, Jen Rudin. Today's guest is the very talented Kira Lee Berger, an Australian-American actress, singer, and dancer who got her start at the age of 4 on Sesame Street. Kira Lee went on to do the Broadway national tours of both Billy Elliot and Mary Poppins before the age of 12. In her adult career, Kira Lee has been lucky to have been in over 100 episodes of television, working with some of the biggest stars in Hollywood, such as Zendaya, Elizabeth Moss, and Katherine McPhee. Some of her most notable credits include The Handmaid's Tale, Casey Undercover, $1, and The Who Was Show. Please join me in welcoming my friend, the supremely talented Kira Lee Berger, to the podcast. So welcome to our podcast. It's so nice to have you. And I love it's very 2020 that here we are making a podcast date to catch up after all these years. But before we even begin our chat, I have to share the memory of when I first met you. I was head of casting at Disney Theatrical Productions, and we were in the final rounds of our Mary Poppins national tour casting. And we had these group auditions for Jane and Michael Banks. And there you were, this 9-year-old Kira Lee with these pigtails that were actually braided pigtails, leaping around doing all these theater games. And I just thought, oh my gosh, that girl is so cute and has so much energy. And we cast you. So we'll get a little bit, we'll get into that a little bit later. But that's how
I remember it so vividly too, because my hair was so curly and it kept getting frizzy. So my mom's like, we've got to braid it down. You can't have this frizzy hair all over the place.
It was adorable and very, very memorable. So, but before
my mom will be very happy to hear that.
Yes. And by the way, I did interview your mom, Dani Berger, in the Stage Parents chapter of Confessions of a Casting Director. So anybody that's doing some cross-reference checking can certainly read that chapter to hear about life on tour with Billy Elliot. But let's talk a little bit about your origin story. How did it happen? How did you become a child actor? Because for me, you are the first young actor I have as a guest on this podcast who has successfully transitioned to being an adult working actor, which is very rare. So tell us your origin story.
Yeah. So, I really think first of all, thank you so much for having me, because I've looked back at the other guests you've had and it's really an honor to be, you know, on a roster with these incredible people that I look up to so much. But I think my origin story really kind of starts with my parents' background. My father is a Broadway drummer. He's done something crazy like 25 or 30 Broadway shows. But my mom actually grew up in Australia, and when she was 20, she came to the United States to pursue acting and dance professionally. She was in the original cast of Jubilee. She was the very first Australian Radio City Rockette. She did 42nd Street and Crazy for You and Sugar Babes and all these amazing, amazing shows. And so my parents didn't necessarily want me to be in the business because they know how hard it is. It's such a tough business. And there's a lot of rejection and heartache. But when I was about 2 years old, this is my mom's most favorite story. I was a kid and still am, frankly, somebody that I'm just always talking. I love to talk. I love to talk to people. I love to tell stories. So being on a podcast is great. In my 2-year checkup with my doctor, he needed to hear me speak. And for some reason, I just would not talk. And my mom was like, can she sing? And he thought that was very strange, but he's like, yeah, I just need to hear that she can form words and doesn't have a speech impediment. And I stood up on the change table in like nothing but a diaper and belted out Tomorrow from Annie. My parents kind of rolled their eyes and were like, oh God, we've got a theater kid. We've created a monster. And there was kind of no stopping it. And about a year later, at the Jewish Community Center in Tenafly, New Jersey, there was an open call for like agents and managers, maybe casting directors. And I stood on a chair and sang, "Oh, You Beautiful Doll." And from that open call, I signed with Shirley Grant Management, who I've now been with for 17 years.
I'm still
with
them today. 17 years. And that's really, that's some good longevity and that's a good relationship. When did you start, when did it start sort of getting as part of your daily world going into the city for auditions? When did that start to get really busy for you?
I mean, really from the get-go. I remember my parents telling me from the age of, 3 and 4, it was like every day. And my dad and I were just talking recently, actually, where he said I would, be in the city for one commercial audition, and then they'd call and say, "There's 3 more. Can she get over there? Can she get over there right now while she's there?" So it was really busy from the start. But I think to preface how young I was so little when I started in the business that every time I went to an audition, I didn't realize it was an audition. I thought I did like every commercial I auditioned for.
I love that. That's like such a nice, It's such a nice optimistic way of viewing auditions. Like, I have the job already. This is the job that I'm doing, without realizing that actually you're auditioning. That's really sweet. I mean, obviously knowing what you know now, I'm sure you look back at that time and it's like, oh, that gentler, kinder time. But I think you've touched on what's really crucial, which is this business is so, so challenging. There are so many highs and so many lows. And I know I certainly felt it when I was a young actor. How did you, as you were starting to compete more and go on these auditions with these possibilities and promise, and maybe you're going to get it. And then if you didn't get it, how did you get on with your day? Because I always feel like that's such an important question to ask actors.
Well, I think throughout the years, that feeling has really changed. Because, now as an adult, if I don't get a job, it's like, how am I going to pay my rent? It's changed. But I think as a child, that feeling, I think what was key of getting through it was support.
From your family. Yeah.
From my family and also my teachers that were around me. I was really, really, really fortunate to have some of the most incredible teachers to help me and to train me in dance and acting and voice. And, it was very much, this one didn't work out, but I always remember my mom saying to me, there's so many factors.
Mm-hmm.
There is so many factors. Meryl Streep could have auditioned for Regina George and she would have done an amazing audition, but Meryl Streep wasn't going to get Regina George because she's just not the right type for that part. So they always kind of instilled in me, especially my parents, because they know that it has so oftentimes has so little to do with talent. There's a million things that go into it. And I was so young that I didn't always necessarily even understand that I didn't book something. It's like, oh, there's another audition tomorrow. Cool. Awesome. Can't wait. What am I singing?
Yeah.
It was so fun for me. I just genuinely loved it so much. But of course there was heartache. And I think there are still jobs that I didn't book from my childhood that I still will kind of never get over. But
yeah.
I think that just means it matters to you and you care.
Yeah. I think that's a really good attitude. And also, are you an only child or are there more siblings?
I am an only child, actually. As a kid, of course, I hated that because I always wanted another sibling to play with. But now that I'm older, I don't know how my parents could have possibly done it with another child.
Because I remember chatting with your mom about the Billy Elliot tour, which I want to talk about that. I remember her saying, it has to be a family conversation with what we're going to do. And I remember her sharing that because you were an only child, she said to your dad, we need to do this. Or your father said, well, there's no, of course we're going to do this to make her dreams come true. And they did make it happen for you, because I do know so many families where one sibling's left home with, one parent and the other one's off having this like fabulous time. And my mother actually did not want to take me on tour. I had an opportunity when I was 11 because she didn't want to leave my father at home with my sister, because that didn't seem fair. I was like, that's not fair at all. This is my dream. And of course I knew that if I went and did the tour, they might might put me, I was thinking like a casting director, that they might put me in the Broadway company if I did a good job on the tour. And she was like, well, yeah. You live in New York, you can just do the Broadway show. And I said, it doesn't work like that. And of course, the girls that went on tour, of course, ended up, you know, getting to perform the role on Broadway. So that's one of my, you know, my regrets. But she just couldn't, my mother just couldn't rationalize it with a family. So I think in one sense, perhaps you were really lucky that you're an only child because you were able to do that. So I know that you were on tour, which is one of these topics that I could do a whole podcast about tours.
I mean, there's so much to talk about.
There is so much to talk about. So what came first, Mary Poppins or Billy Elliot?
Mary Poppins came first. I was 9 years old, which is crazy. I actually think I may have been the youngest.
Yes, I think you were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is crazy to me. And looking back, I mean, when I went on the Mary Poppins tour, I still brought my Barbies to rehearsal.
Oh.
And my teddy bear to rehearsal. Mm-hmm. That's how young I was. And, you know, while there were, I think one of the other Janes was already a freshman in high school. I mean, the age range, the age gap was crazy. I did Mary Poppins first, and then 2 years later, I did Billy Elliot at the age of 11.
And how long were you on that tour for?
I was on the Billy Elliot tour for, I believe, a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't want to talk about the boring stuff like school at the pool or however it went on tour. You're in Billy Elliot, and you're on tour with how many other kids?
22.
So was that like the time of your life, or was this like a microcosm little world of what school was like, even though none of you were at regular school? I mean, what were the highs and lows of that experience?
You know, I'm going to be really frank. Billy Elliot was a very challenging time in my life because the age gap between all of us, I mean, we had a child at the beginning of the tour who was 5 years old, and then we had a 16-year-old girl.
Yeah.
It was just such a huge range. And of course, when you're dealing with, you know, teens and tweens, there's drama. And those times can be really tough, but at the same time, we're a family. We're all we've got, because there were a lot of kids. Most of the kids on that tour were not only children. So they were on tour with nannies and guardians. And that was so, so difficult for so many kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, the hours were also really difficult, because not only were we rehearsing and doing the show, we also had to do school. And a lot of us were in really challenging years in junior high or even high school. I mean, we had a girl that was in her junior year of high school.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of really wonderful highs and then really challenging lows on that tour.
Because also the show is 3 hours long, and I've seen it so many times on Broadway, and I would go backstage, like I'd have cousins in visiting or friends, and we go backstage and I'd think to myself, it's 11 o'clock at night and you have just come off stage tap dancing in that finale, and now you have to go home and do your homework and go to school tomorrow. You know, how do you, it's one thing if you're on tour and you're bouncing around in the hotel room on the hotel bed, you know, bouncing around having a snack before you go to sleep, but to have to go home and then go to school the next day, like there's just, where is the rest period, I guess. And so it sounded like when I chatted with Danny, your mom, for the book, and this was back in like 2013, it sounded like you had rehearsal all day, then you had to go to school, then you had to be fed, and then you had to do the show.
That's exactly what it was like, yeah.
Are you still friends with some of those girls or boys?
Absolutely, I am. I mean, one of the girls, we ended up going to French Woods together, summer camp together. You know, Olivia Wong, I still talk to all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we just have such a special bond in such a challenging and unique experience that we all went through together.
Yeah.
It's not one of those experiences that a lot of people can relate to. They're like, wait, you went to, you know, 20 cities when you were 11?
Yeah.
You know, it's such a unique bond that we all have, as well as some of the Michaels and the Billies I'm still close with to this day.
Yeah, I guess, you know, what's so interesting, I had a friend who, my sister's neighbor, and they went on tour with School of Rock, and she's like, I can do anything for 6 months. And I said, okay, just reread the book, reread that chapter in my book, Confessions of a Casting Director, because you're going to be sharing a hotel room with your 11-year-old son for 6 months. And FYI, travel day, which is Monday, is technically your day off, quote unquote. And it's not like you're traveling like direct flights. Of course, they're always going to put you on those. So can you share, since I always love the sort of messy stories, can you share like the craziest travel day and the craziest thing that happened on stage? And then we'll sort of move to the joyful parts of live theater. But what was the, you know, a crazy travel day or a crazy moment on stage for you in that particular show, which is so technical and so precise and really, truly, Kira Lee, one of my favorite shows ever and favorite movies.
Well, I'm pretty sure I have the story to end all stories.
Okay.
I mean, as for travel days, our company manager, Sean, was so fantastic that, you know, of course there were little kerfuffles. The only travel day that I can remember is somebody had their laptop computer stolen at TSA. That was really, really tough. So, you know, things like that happen, especially, She was one of the nannies, and she was taking care of like two or three kids on the tour. And it was one of those things where she turned her head for a second, looked back, and somebody had taken her computer. Eventually, we were able to sort it out, and I believe we did find it. But that was definitely scary.
Yeah.
Because I mean, you can imagine with such a huge cast, because not only are there 22 kids, there's a massive ensemble cast.
Right.
There's a lot of us and crazy things happen, but I really do think I have the wildest onstage story of all time. So in the beginning of the show, there's the iconic number Shine. Of course, we all know and love. So iconic. And there's that fabulous moment where we do the quick change and we come out with the feather fans and do the fantastic ending with the wind. And it's the, you know, the crazy pink feather tutus with glitter and tiaras. Mm-hmm. It's great. But we all come out in a line, crouch down behind a feather fan. We switch the feather fan, and then we have to run backwards. So we cannot see where we're going. Well, the two littlest girls come out first. By the way, our smallest ballet girl who played Allison Summers weighed 35 pounds.
Oh.
So thank goodness she was not involved in this, because I think it could have been really bad. Well, the third girl fell. And when we're running backwards, we can't see which way, what's happening behind us. So every girl fell on top of the next girl. And we were all in a pile on stage. And there was one mom in the audience trying to scream for them to stop the show. I was the last girl to come out. I couldn't see what was going on behind me. So every girl that tried to stand up was underneath me. And I smacked my head on the side of the stage. And I go into, we call it tutu, where we kind of put the fans on Mrs. Wilkinson's hips to make it look like she's wearing a tutu. And the boy that was on for Billy, his face just went white. And I had blood on my forehead. And I got off the stage. Several girls were injured. I got a concussion, was out of the show for 2 weeks.
Oh my God. Did they stop that performance?
They did not.
Wow. The show must.
Because it happened so unbelievably quickly. Everyone was, by the time we all got up and started dancing again, they were like, what just happened?
Right.
You know, those things happened so quickly.
That's really scary. That's really scary. Yeah. And you know, you spend 2 weeks. So what are you now in your hotel room, like trying to not be nauseous or something?
Yeah. Well, we were in Tampa, Florida, and I was sitting in my bed, nauseous and dizzy,
aww,
you know, sitting in my bed with sunglasses on and, you know, my mom trying to feed me like sips of broth.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, the girls were so sweet. Those ballet girls are wonderful. And they would stop by my hotel room before and after the show and bring me soup or, you know, a treat that they would sometimes leave at the theater. So they were really great. And, you know, sometimes they'd come and hang out with me while I would sit in bed.
But yeah.
It's crazy because I can recall watching movies, which you're very much not supposed to do when you have a concussion. So but it was like a decade ago, you know.
Yeah, a lifetime ago. So what happened? Did you end up being homeschooled through the rest of high school? Or did you go to professional children's school?
So I actually went to public high school for 3 days.
Yeah, that's right.
I went to public high school for 3 days. And, you know, before Billy Elliot, when I was 10, grade 5, I was very, very, very severely bullied. I mean, it was really, really bad, both emotionally and sometimes it got physical. It was really a challenge. And I was really frightened to go back to high school because I'd been away from those kids for, you know, 4 years. But I thought in my head, you know, gosh, what if they remember me and it starts all over again? And my parents were like, no, you've changed so much. Everyone's gotten older. Oh, no. Mm. It was right back to where it was before. And I, you know, sat my parents down after the second day. And I said to them, you know, I'm going to school so that I can get really high marks so that I can hopefully, at the time, I was very serious about going to UCLA for musical theater. That was my dream. You know, I want to go to school so that I can get good marks, that I can go to UCLA and get a higher education, and I'm not going to put myself through this.
Mm-hmm.
I would really, really love to homeschool if that's possible. And, you know, everything kind of worked out in our favor. It gave me more flexibility for work, and I had more time with my studies. I could do my work on my own time, and I had a little bit more choice of what classes I wanted to take. And I didn't have to deal with the bullying anymore.
Yeah. Yep. And did
so
you have,
I homeschooled for all of high school.
That's what I remember. Cause you used to come over and we used to do our taping and coaching. And did you have, you know, I'm all for homeschooling when it works out. Where did you still have girlfriends and sleepovers and all that normal stuff that, you know, keeps you and young? Did you have your socializing through Dance World or through your actor friends?
My socialization 100% came from dance.
Yeah.
But mainly, more than anything, was my experience at Frenchwood Festival of Performing Arts, which is a sleepaway camp in the Catskills.
Yes, which is the competitor to my camp, which was Stage Door Manor. But it's great. No, it's great that you went there because these friendships at these theater camps, they were lifelong friendships, believe me.
All of my best friends, every single one of my best friends came from dance class at Dance Molinari, run
yep.
by Janine Molinari, who has trained, you know, Ariana Grande and the Jonas Brothers. No big deal.
And we should have her. Yes, we'll have Janine on the podcast at some point. She's amazing.
And French Woods as well, all of my best friends. But also I did scholarship pageants for a little while. I competed in the Miss America organization, and a lot of my really close friends came from that as well.
That's nice. Now I want to jump to all of a sudden when I least like we lost a little touch, and then there you are on this CBS All Access show, and you're living in Pittsburgh filming it. So did you then decide to move to LA to pursue film and TV? I mean, you left New York and made a big change. And my other favorite chapter in the book, in Confessions of a Casting Director, is the LA versus New York chapter because there's so many differences. So how did you end up in LA?
Sure. So I booked right out of high school, 6 weeks to the day of me graduating high school. I booked a series regular on a Netflix series called The Who Was Show, based on the Penguin Who Was books,
mm-hmm.
which we filmed in Brooklyn, New York. We filmed 12 episodes in like 6 weeks. It was craziness. But immediately after that, I mean, I think I had about 2 days off, and then I went right to LA. I booked what was supposed to be a one episode guest star on Casey Undercover on the Disney Channel. So I went to LA by myself at 17 years old, thinking it was going to be a one episode guest star. I ended up doing 5 or 6 episodes. They kept me until the end of the season finale.
I love it.
I know, it was such a wonderful kind of chance thing where it wasn't a conscious decision to move to LA. Life just kind of happened and brought me there. I never really saw myself in LA because, you know, I think once a New Yorker, always a New Yorker, but life just kind of brought me here. And after I finished Casey Undercover, I had a conversation with my team and we realized, you know, the momentum is here right now. It would kind of be silly to go back to New York at this point.
I totally agree.
I stayed, and yeah, it's so funny because specifically with $1, the CBS All Access series, through the audition process, I never thought that I would book it. You know, I loved it so much, but I always thought, you know, this could never happen. So it's great that I'm getting these callbacks. And then when I got the call that I booked it, I mean, it was truly the happiest day of my life.
I wonder, that's also a really good attitude, because I sort of feel like the auditions that we put all of our heart and soul into are sometimes the most heartbreaking ones. And here's an example where you were totally rational. You go for your auditions like any other audition, and you know, and surprise, surprise, you get this one. And I think that's a really good lesson that, like, you know, we just don't know. There's no trajectory in this career. It's hard to say how. I mean, I know in casting, you know, I feel like I present the choices and then, you know, we see who the team wants to hire, but that's a really nice story. So you, when you least expected it, boom, you know, and then where, meanwhile, are you living in LA by yourself? Is your mom like
living in Los Angeles by myself at the age of 18 years old?
And where did you first start out living when you moved there?
Oh, the Oakwood.
Yeah, perfect. Of course. Of course.
Of course it's the Oakwood. And then I went to the other place where everyone goes, Park La Brea. Just everyone listening to the podcast that's thinking about going to LA, don't move to Park La Brea. Just give you a piece of advice.
Yeah, there's so many other options. I mean, we don't have time to really delve into the differences between LA and New York, except I always say, like, you can't just show up in LA. You have to have a plan. And Lord knows you have to know how to drive.
You really do. And that was, I think, what was so crazy is I was in LA, a teenager, by myself, trying to, you know, figure everything out for the first time in my life, having to make very big adult decisions like leasing. I don't know how to do that. And I just kind of had to figure it out.
Yeah. And also, you know, I feel like you moved there before Uber and Lyft really took hold. And so getting your driving around, figuring out how to get there, where to park, what does it mean when they give you a drive on at a studio? Where are you going to validate?
Well, the funny thing is, because I was a New York kid, I didn't know how to drive when I came to LA. I actually learned to drive for $1 on CBS All Access. They taught me how to drive for the park.
I love it. Yeah. I didn't really know how to drive either. And, you know, it's kind of crazy how, you know, you're sort of thrown into a situation and you learn on the job. So we're going to take a quick pause and then we're going to take a quick commercial break and then we will be back. Okay. We are back. So Kiralee is now booked a series regular, on a TV show for CBS All Access that's called, $1. It's filming in Pittsburgh. And so what, you know, this always bothers me with actors. Everybody always thinks that they can be like that they're a theater person and they want to do film and TV. And let's not even get into voiceover, which is a whole other thing. So you have worked in theater and now suddenly you're working on television. And so what is the biggest difference for you or what are some of the differences, not just technically, but in terms of the type of acting that you're doing that you noticed when you got hired for this TV show? And you could mention Casey Undercover, but I feel like more with the CBS All Access one, since that's a little bit more recent.
Sure. I mean, you know, doing the Who Was show and Casey Undercover as well, I think, you know, those kind of taught me how to work in TV, you know, with the scheduling and how camera setups work and turning it around. So I was glad I couldn't have done $1 without those experiences prior. Mm-hmm. But $1 was a whole different ballgame. I mean, I'm working with some of the biggest actors in television, John Carroll Lynch, Jeff Perry, Alexa Palladino, Leslie Odom Jr. as well, who's also a theater person. But then we also had massive stars like Sturgill Simpson. It was just this crazy, huge thing. It was just such a massive scale, as well as, you know, director Craig Zobel, who's a genius. But the thing that I think really struck me was the hours. Because before that I was under 18, so mm-hmm. I could only work a certain amount of hours. This was my really first job as an adult actor. I mean, there were times where I would work 20 hours
in a day. Yeah.
You know, getting home at even 7 in the morning was not uncommon. But I think the other switch that I think was really, I was really lucky that I had my background in theater is I come from the school of thought of you've got one shot to get it right because it's live theater.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have that thing of, okay, we'll do a warm-up take, and then if I mess up, it's fine, we'll do it again. You know, I still, I mean, years later, have the brain of a theater person where I just try and nail it on the first take, which a lot of people love because we get out of there a little faster. But, you know, especially with the way that Craig Zobel specifically works, and there was a very specific tone and style to $1. It's very, very, the thing that I love about that show so much is it's very grounded. These people are real. All of these characters, it feels like you know them because you do. Everyone knows a person like this or a person like that. It was very grounded. And, you know, theater is larger than life. You know, Mary Poppins is, you're not our nanny. It's like, nobody talks like that, but it's theater. So, I mean, I remember very vividly, actually, this one shot in one of the episodes of $1, in one of the later episodes, actually, where my character finds this piece of paper that has a very shocking piece of information on it. And my first instinct was, you know, this big gasp, and, you know, my eyes well up with tears, and I'm looking around, you know, shocked, don't know what to do. And the director was like, bring it down.
Mm-hmm.
You're genuinely in a state of shock. The shock comes first, then the emotion comes. So you need to take a second to just take in the fact that you're even seeing this. You don't even understand what it is yet. So to bring it down and condense it almost smaller than it would be in real life, that was very challenging to grasp.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so lucky that I had the experience of $1 because it felt like it was college to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these amazing actors that are, you know, Emmy nominated and Grammy winners, they were my professors. And the set of $1 was my college.
Yeah,
it was
or your
amazing BFA masterclass I could have ever received.
No, you're very lucky because, you know, you can take all these on-camera classes, some of which I teach to young actors, but you just don't know until you get onto that set. And it's very subtle. You know, Dennis Boutsakaris, who's an actor, an Obie Award-winning actor, is quoted in Confessions of a Casting Director saying, you know, I'm on stage for 2 hours and my performance has to reach the back of the theater and I have to project and everybody in the back row needs to be experiencing it the same way that people in the orchestra are. And then when I'm on Law and Order playing a lawyer, they put me in a suit, I raise an eyebrow, they underscore some music and I've had an acting moment. And I love that. When the book went to print, I said to Dennis, I need to get you to sign off on that quote. And he's like, I don't remember saying that. I'm like, well, I do. Because to me, it so clearly demonstrated the differences between these two worlds, which now you have knowledge and you can do that. So what do you wish, you know, as we sort of wrap this up, what do you wish you could tell your younger self knowing what you know today?
I mean, I think, you know, the moment everything took off for me, because I had a period of time, I didn't work for 6 years. And then out of nowhere, I just kind of started booking one thing after the other, after the next, and it sort of started rolling along and momentum started to pick up. And I think when everything really changed for me was when I made a conscious decision to stop trying to be what I thought the casting director or the producers were looking for. And I went into every audition with the sole aim of being able to walk out of that room after that audition and say, if I could go back, I wouldn't change anything. I have given the best performance I could have possibly given, and that is enough.
Good.
Because you never know what they're looking for. When a writer writes a character, they have a voice in their head of what that person sounds like, the way their hair moves, what color they're wearing. There's no way you could ever be inside that person's head. So all you can try and do is get the best performance you could possibly give. Give 100% of whatever you have that day. And of course, there's still going to be heartbreak, but going in with that sole aim takes away a lot of the hurt and the pain that comes along with, but I tried so hard and da-da-da-da-da. You know what? It's okay because I couldn't have done anything more.
Yeah.
There's nothing more I could have done.
Yeah. And I think also that gives the actor a little bit of control. You know, I always say there's so little you can control in the audition experience.
Absolutely.
And if you can at least control that you were prepared and early and gave a good, you know, gave a great audition and had a good time. And then you sort of go off, call your mother, go to lunch, you know, go to yoga and forget about it and move on. And of course it's easier said than done, but I think that's a really good, profound, smart takeaway and teachable moment for all of the actors who are listening. And, you know, you have wonderful parents. So what is your advice for parents who want to get their kids into this business? Now, your parents were both in the business already, so they were savvy and knowledgeable and also aware of how crazy it was. But I mean, do you think kids should be doing this? I mean, I have this question with myself every day. What do you think?
You know, here's truly what I think. If you have a child who never stops singing, never stops dancing, I'm serious about it. If you take them to a dancing class and they're asking you every 5 seconds, when's the next class? When's the next class? It's clear that they are the person that wants to be doing this more than anything. Then yes, your child should be doing this. But if there's any doubt, if there's ever pushback of, I don't want to go to that audition today, or, you know, I don't want to go to dancing class. And my mom has always said, she would ask me over and over again as a kid, you know, you're taking 5 dance classes. Do you really want to take another one? It's okay if you don't. I won't be mad. And you'd be like, yeah, I want to do 10. Mm-hmm. You know, if that child has the hunger for it, they should be doing it. But if there's ever pushback, it is a lot for a family to go through to have a child in this business.
Yep, yep.
So I think it's a lot of knowing your child really, yeah, really well, and being able to read their emotions as well, I think is really key. Because, I mean, especially on tour, there's fatigue and there's being overworked. So being able to read your child, I think, is also very much key. But I think the support of a family,
yeah,
is the number one thing that a child needs. Because if I didn't have the support from not only my parents but my teachers,
yeah,
of me, you know, even my parents saying like, ugh, isn't she a little young for Mary Poppins or a little young for Billy Elliot? They said both those things, both shows. They thought I was way too young. But my teachers being like, let's just try, see what happens. Let's support her and, you know, we'll see what happens. And I booked both of them.
That's right.
People around me.
Yeah.
But I think was really key.
Yeah, that's great. So, 2 final questions. We'll talk about social media at the end where people can find you. What's next for you acting wise, if you're at liberty to say?
I have 2 projects that will be coming out on Netflix in the near future. I am starring in Malibu Rescue 2, The Next Wave. I know there's a lot of Malibu Rescue fans out there. But I also have just started a new project called Country Comfort, starring Catherine McPhee. Might have heard of her. She's pretty fantastic.
Yes.
And that will be coming out on Netflix eventually, don't exactly know when. And I also have a top secret project that I can't announce just yet, but very soon. I know a lot of people will be really, really excited about that one. So keep your eyes peeled when I'm allowed to announce that.
Yes. And I have one too for Netflix that's also top secret that I'm casting that I can't announce yet either. Netflix taking over the world, making us sign NDAs. It's incredible. And where can people find you on social media to keep up with Kira Lee Berger?
Yeah, you can find me at Kira Lee Berger on pretty much everything, on Instagram, Twitter, and even an occasional TikTok.
I don't even know. It's like, I know what TikTok is, but I'm just getting good on Instagram at the moment. And I feel pretty proud of myself, for being so cutting edge. I feel like the moms, and the stage moms and I are, we all understand Facebook perfectly. And then for Instagram, we look to you all to help us out figuring out our stories and how to post stuff. So someday I will be able to be facile in both. I'm so excited to talk to you and have you as our first young actor guest on the Confessions of a Casting Director podcast. Thank you so much for your time. Go out and enjoy
the
LA sunshine.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I feel so honored.
It was so nice to chat with you, and hopefully I will see you in, you know, Santa Monica, Venice, somewhere sunny and warm really soon. Thanks. For more episodes of Confessions of a Casting Director, visit jenruden.com/podcast or wherever you get your podcast fix. Please also subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes and tell your friends. If you love the show as much as I love doing it, please consider supporting us with a contribution to keep our show going. You can find contribution links at jenrudencasting.com/podcast. You can also follow us on Instagram at RudenJ and Confessions Casting Podcast. Thanks for listening.